Group meeting, Saturday, 1st October 1983. We all know only too well what a state the world is in and towards what it seems to be moving. And I think it is perfectly obvious that this is due to the fact that millions of people the world over are unable to live the human life. And the human life really means the religious life. And the religious life does not mean religious in the conventional sense of the word. Whatsoever purifies the individual, relates him rightly to his environment and to the world in which he lives, and enables him to realize his own human fruition through realizing transcendence in the true sense, that is religion. And of course, religion has its own discipline. Its own discipline, which is not something separate from the discipline of our daily life. It is the discipline of our daily life which enables us, if we care for this sort of thing, it enables us to bring about that transformation in our mode of awareness of existence, which makes all the difference between a man living more or less bestially, certainly subhumanly, and a man who is working towards not just his own human fruition, but the benefit of all mankind. As long as we think in terms of our own benefit or fruition, we are making a great mistake. For the very simple reason that no human being is unrelated to the whole human race, in fact, to the entire universe. Modern science itself is showing more and more clearly that the entire cosmos, which seems and which certainly in the past was believed to consist of innumerable, countless, separate objects and out there, so to say, and oneself in here, separate from everything, modern science is showing that that is a hopelessly false attitude. It isn't true at all. Every single thing in the cosmos is interrelated and interactive with every other thing in the cosmos. And this interaction and interrelationship is of such a nature that every single thing, from an atom to a human being or any object or person or whatever it is, affects the entire cosmos, just as the entire cosmos affects every single particular individual or atom or thing that there is in the universe. In short, the universe is a unitary whole. It is this sense of holiness that we still have to realize for ourselves. We cannot cultivate it in this sense that now I shall cultivate a sense of the wholeness of the universe. You can't predetermine it like that. You have to let it grow. You can no more predetermine this as you could have predetermined just into what sort of a body you would have grown when you were born. It was quite impossible. And even if you had ideas coming into your heads when you were 2 years, 3 years, 5 years old, did you ever find those ideas come to fruition? Or did life itself make that body, that physical body, grow up into what it has grown up? So in the same way, we cannot predetermine that we will achieve this, that or the other, supreme fulfillment or spiritual realization or something like that. You cannot predetermine it. You can have a vision of it, yes, your own vision. But bear in mind that if you fixate your vision, you have doomed yourself to failure. There is no such thing as fixation anywhere in the universe. There is this constant change, this perpetual change which goes on all the time. We can influence that change to move in what may turn out to be the right direction. Let us not be too certain that we know what is the truth. We know what is good for a human being. We know how to effect your salvation. The Spanish Inquisition thought that way. They knew how to effect people's salvation, so they burnt them at the stake. And, I mean, that's one example out of literally thousands and thousands of examples of human error and folly. So, our task is to work in cooperation as far as we are able to cooperate, and as far as we are able to see the trend in the whole process of evolution throughout the world. This is very important. Now, if one could begin even to have something like a true vision of the reality and of the nature of that movement towards development of the human being and his fulfillment, then we will be able quite naturally and spontaneously to see what course of action will mark that development and fulfillment. But always keep an open mind, ready to accept change as it comes about, and work according to that change. I'm not suggesting that one should be entirely pragmatic. I don't mean it in that sense. Because when we see a change taking place, which is obviously for the worse, then there is no point in trying to cooperate with that. We are merely making the situation more and more evil, more and more difficult. Now, as I said in the beginning, whatsoever purifies the individual, relates him rightly to his environment and to the world, and enables him to realize transcendence in his own life, if possible, that is religion. Now, if you take the word religion, which is derived, according to Cicero, from re legere, the meaning is to gather together. To gather together into a harmonious, unified pattern. But I think the meaning which was given by Servius, Lactantius, and by St. Augustine is a more significant meaning. They said that the word religion, religio, comes from religare, which means to bind back to the source. To bind back to the source. You must remember, these people, of course, were theists. So the source had to be God. To bind back to God. That was their idea. Now, I think we can find a better word and a healthier concept than binding back to God. The whole idea of binding back to the source implies a restriction, as a constriction of oneself, instead of realizing the true freedom of oneself. Now, supposing we look at it, we'll take a series of words. To return back to the source. A returning can imply something which you do of your own free will and accord. There is no compulsion involved in that returning. And with that sort of returning, there is a better chance of being rightly related to all other like-minded people who are returning back to the source. And if you want to go still further, still deeper, in as presented, for instance, in Patanjali's yoga, his definition of yoga, yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. He said that yoga is the fading away, nirodha, the fading away of all fluctuations of attentiveness. Fading away of all these fluctuations. You remember in Genesis how after Adam ate the fruit and he was hiding, so to say, and the Lord God was walking in the garden, and the Lord God said, "Adam, where art thou?" Why should an omniscient, all-seeing God need to ask, "Where are you, Adam?" No need at all, because nothing is hid from the eyes of the transcendent. All right, what is the meaning then? Where art thou, Adam? At what level of consciousness are you functioning? What are you paying attention to now that you've eaten this fruit of the tree of good and evil? The knowledge of good and evil. Don't forget the word knowledge in that context. What does it mean? It means that he who was in unknowing communion, but total communion with transcendence, having eaten this fruit, has now now finds his attention wandering away from the transcendent. That is the real meaning of that. So it seems to me. So now, this definition in yoga, the fading away of the fluctuations of attentiveness, chitta vritti. And I like to use the word attentiveness in connection with chitta in this particular context, because this is the actual fact of what happens with us human beings. That is why I use that. I don't like the use of the word mind in that context. The fluctuations of the mind. It isn't fluctuations of mind. It's the fluctuations of your attention all the time. And then we can see that if this ceases in the right way, that is to say, the whole of the psyche is pacified, then there is the possibility of the state of union with, of communion in the true sense with transcendence. I like to use the word being integrated into the source. You see, anything which is done deliberately, purposively, has a certain mechanical element to it. You join together two things, yourself and God, or yourself and the Supreme, whatever that Supreme may be. But still, in consciousness, there is a separation. That and I. But what actually happens in the process of religious living, which in the true sense is the perfect human living, what happens is that this separative, isolative consciousness of oneself completely dissolves. It completely disappears. If that completely disappears, all selfness, all separate selfness vanishes, and the relationship between what was just me and the self and the rest of the universe as the not-self, that relationship has become perfect. I no longer intrude upon the cosmos. So this transformation of consciousness takes place. And but because of this integration, that which existed and exists during its lifetime on the earth as a separate human being is no longer separate. He or she is completely at one with the totality. Again, don't regard totality as separate from the one, myself or yourself. It is not separate. When you are integrated, it's a live process. Any joining together deliberately is a mechanical process. And whatsoever is a put together, as the Buddha used to say, will come apart. It belongs to the realm of mortality, not to the realm of immortality. And your immortality is not hereafter. It is right here, right now, if you can realize that state of attentiveness which enables you to be in complete communion with the totality. Otherwise, there is no immortality. Now, I mentioned this transformation of consciousness. What do we mean when we say we are conscious of this, that, or the other? What we do know, what everybody more or less knows, is just this, that if impressions reach this organism, oneself, from outside, through the senses, and if one is paying attention to those impressions, then one becomes conscious of that which is sending out those impressions to oneself. That is being conscious. But I would like to suggest there is a totally different way of looking at it all. We know from our own living experience that what we are conscious, what we are aware of, what we know, as we say, is an infinitesimal fraction of all that there could be known. That which lies beyond our ken is transcendent to us. I'm using the word transcendence in that sense, transcendent in that sense. It is transcendent to us. But as and when we can become conscious of that which lies beyond our ken, then that is no longer transcendent. We are at home with it. We are part and parcel of it, and it is part and parcel of us. Now the question arises, what is the source of it all? And all the theistic religions, of course, have said God is the creator and so forth. You all know all about that. Now, there is one special usefulness with that word God. It's a monosyllable. And it's very easy to use. Transcendent has three syllables in it. The Supreme Being has three supreme being, four syllables in it, and so forth. The word God is very simple, and we can just use it and equate that word with all these other concepts or words which we can use. It is convenient to do so. But do bear in mind, the whole world through the ages has made the mistake of trying to define God, to present God in human concepts and human words. As you yourself grow from within your own being and your consciousness really becomes more and more enlightened, you will find that each and every one of those concepts and words is not true. Usually, those concepts and words are not only inadequate, but they are positively misleading. Look how easily people read themselves into their God. For the bulk of English people, God is an Englishman. He belongs to his own club. He wouldn't do this, that and the other. Why not? Why wouldn't God do this, that and the other? Well, I, an Englishman, wouldn't do this, that and the other. Then obviously God won't do this, that and the other. You see, this is a peculiar tendency in all human beings. In Africa, God is colored black. In Europe and in the Americas, God is colored white. And God is a he, and has been a he only for a few centuries, a few millennia perhaps. But even to this day, in some parts of India, God is a she. Palichi Amal, for example, among some of the people, is the name given. She, as the supreme goddess, must obviously have a husband somewhere, just like any woman has a husband somewhere. That is their belief. So you see how our concepts and words are really very troublesome things. If we just use the word, I always use transcendence because it has not been used so frequently. And when you use a word frequently, it gets loaded and it spoils the situation. So that is why I use transcendence. Where transcendence is concerned, you are dealing with the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. That is transcendent to us altogether. But when I say that, I do not mean that that context is something outside us, something separate from us. This is very important. Our context, my context as an ordinary human being, is the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. My whole living process functions in terms of finitude, temporality, and mortality. And this, we can be pretty certain, holds good for the whole human race. Now, the transcendent context is not a context which is separate from, other than, this context in which you and I function, the finite, temporal, and mortal. That transcendent context completely interpenetrates this finite, temporal, and mortal context. The whole of infinity, the whole of eternity, completely functions in and through the finite and the temporal. Shall I put it in other words? The totality, which we may call God, or Brahman, or Allah, or Ahura Mazda, or whatever word you like, the totality of that functions through each and every atom, object, planet, galaxy, cosmos. This is the mystery. How does it happen? I don't know. That is to say, it is so far it has been impossible for me to try and use words which are not misleading, which are not inadequate, but which might be suggestive of the reality of transcendence permeating each and everything. Each and everything of which we are conscious only in terms of separateness is actually that transcendence materialized. I like to call that transcendence the primordial creative energy, for a very simple reason. We live in a scientific age, and the word energy has become the operative word for this age. Energy. It is a creative energy. In the past too, what have human beings done? God, the source, is the omnipotent, the omniscient, the omnipresent. All the theologies, the religions of the past, right up almost to modern times, have presented the source in that manner. But omnipotence, power, creative energy, what else? We do not know the nature of that creative energy. We cannot know it. Omniscience, it simply does not mean encyclopedic knowledge, in our sense of the word knowledge. It simply does not mean that. It means a consciousness which is immediately and absolutely aware of not only the totality, but of every single thing that composes the totality. That is an extraordinary consciousness. Can you be conscious that way? Can I? I can't. But you can sometimes, when the organism is quiet, pure, the psyche is utterly pure and clean, not obstructing the activity of transcendence, then you can thrill in consciousness to that transcendent reality. And once you do that, no arguments, no evidence can be brought to shake you from your realization. You know that this is so. That is all. When you are really in love, nothing can shake the truth of that. You have to experience it. If you experience it, you know that what I'm saying is true. But if you don't experience it, you can challenge what I'm saying, and I shall never answer the challenge. Because it's no good answering challenges of that sort. That which has to be realized by the living being is something which must not be challenged. Let him realize it in his own sweet time, in his own sweet way. And the omnipresence, now that corresponds to the omniscience, this extraordinary consciousness, this absolute consciousness. It is because of that kind of consciousness, which is God consciousness, that Jesus said, "Not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it." My Father in heaven knows nothing at all in the manner in which I know things with my brain. That kind of knowing is a being conscious. When you are conscious like that, then you are that of which you are conscious. It's an extraordinary thing altogether. If one is really conscious of wisdom or love, not as an idea about it, not as a belief, not as a conviction, not as a set of thoughts or logical systems, but if you are really conscious of wisdom or love, your whole life of thought and feeling, of word and action, will naturally, spontaneously, invariably and inevitably express love, wisdom all the time. You see now why that which belongs to the transcendent, that which is truly transcendent, cannot be cultivated by me, the ordinary man. If I live in that manner which enables that sort of consciousness to come to fruition, then it all just happens. And even the brain can know it and live by it. So now, this is the sort of consciousness which characterizes this primordial creative energy. It is not a conscious energy in the sense that you and I can consciously utilize some energy, electric or magnetic or gravitational or whatever it is, utilize that energy to bring about a predetermined or a desired result. It's not like that. It's not like anything that we here in our context of the finite, temporal and mortal know about. You will say, oh, but my goodness, this is just hopeless. I can't do anything about it. Of course you can't. Of course you can't do anything about transcendence. Transcendence does everything about you and me. What I can do, the ordinary mortal, to use the Catholic phrase, born in sin, what I can do is to clean myself. The Catholics put it that way. The Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads put it this way. The body is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity, who is the creator of the universe. My duty is to keep the temple clean. If I keep the temple clean, then Shiva's transcendent light, love, wisdom, beauty, goodness, everything functions through the purified temple. That is how it is. You see, in order to appreciate an outlook of this sort, and I'm not suggesting for a moment this is a final truth. God forfend that I ever speak in those terms. There is no such thing as a final truth in the sense that it is expressible in words and concepts. It isn't. But if we can begin to appreciate this, we will see how we can do our particular task in our everyday life, living as human beings in a world full of human beings. To put it really accurately, how I, as an ordinary subhuman, can so live in a world full of other subhumans in such a way that the purification takes place and the realization of the purpose of our existence can naturally come about. What is the purpose of human existence? No human purpose, that is to say, no purpose thought out by me, the ordinary man, would express the purpose of our existence. It is not I who become perfect, who becomes liberated, fulfilled, or anything like that. It is transcendence itself all the time, which comes to fruition through you or me, the clean temple, as a perfect human being. Transcendence realizes perfect humanity through the human organism. You and I don't realize anything. Don't ever believe that you'll ever get to heaven or nirvana or any such thing. Because what is that which is you, that which one recognizes as I, myself, is the totally perishable. Transcendence itself resides inside every single being, every single organism, every single atom of the universe. But it does not compel anything in any way. It just lives through in everything and through everything as an everlasting beneficial influence. It's an influence. But it's an influence which will never compel. It is our business to wake up to that. And in waking up to that, we can live truly religiously.